Good afternoon. Welcome to What Comes Next Live. This afternoon, my guest is Ben Brabin, what can I say about Ben other than that he and I have for about 3 years, often at the coffee shop at Level 39, where he was the chief executive, looked to some of the big questions that could be answered around leadership for this country and beyond. And so I'm really happy to have Ben on for half an hour for a live audience and for people to listen to and watch later. And with that minimal introduction, over to you, Ben. Tell us a bit about yourself and what comes next. What's on your mind?
Well, Tom, thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to join you this afternoon. And what a great question to challenge us with in these uncertain times. We'll introduce myself briefly by way of background. As you said, you and I met 3 years ago at Level 39, and I spent the 4 years up until March, really the beginning of the lockdown. I left Level 39 the week before the lockdown began. So up until that point, I'd spent 4 years running Level 39, which is a cluster of fintech and cybersecurity companies. But turning the clock further back, I started life growing up on a farm. Then I studied a philosophy and English literature degree before spending 5 years as a Royal Marine. And then I left the Marines in 2000 and came up to London. And largely, I think, as a result of misunderstanding, got a job as an investment banker. Great misunderstanding for me. I learned a great deal. I left JP Morgan, where I was 2001 to 2010, building a business. Sold it in 2010. Got involved in a couple of other startups, which didn't really go anywhere. Had a brain tumor, which partly explains, I think, why the startups weren't a great success. But I was very fortunate and recovered fully from that, and was then approached by the UK government to introduce overseas investors to UK companies. So I spent a couple of years working for what was then called UK Trade and Investment. It's now become the Department for International Trade. I left there in 2015 and was approached by Canary Wharf Group, who own Level 39. And since leaving Level 39 in March of this year, I've been trying to figure out exactly the answer to your question, what comes next, and how I can play a useful part in it.
Okay. A lot there. So, we can talk about anything you like. We've had some big picture conversations at times. There's Gini shares you can talk about, which is, I remember having a conversation with you when you were talking to probably a whole bunch of people about what might this look like and just developing ideas. But perhaps just talk us through how that idea evolve, because I think that might give people listening or watching an idea as to what you know, your process for developing ideas.
Sure. Well, thank you. You're absolutely right. This is an idea which has taken some time, and tracing it back to its origins, around about the time we met, in fact, about 3 years ago, I was very conscious, sitting at the heart of this incredible cluster of brilliant people in Canary Wharf in London, 50 different nationalities, 200 companies, addressing every kind of innovation in fintech and cybersecurity especially. And it was very clear that great things were being done, but that those things were quite hard for people to understand. Often these were companies which were achieving transformation deep inside complex global financial services businesses. So it wasn't the kind of technology or business that most people would be able to relate to. And that was something that concerned me, because I thought, this is important because it really does create value, but it's not well placed to foster trust. Here are people making themselves, in some cases, fantastically wealthy, but in ways which are not obvious, not transparent, not easy to understand, and most of all, not easy to relate to. So I thought, there's a risk here. There's a risk that we will lose trust, and with it, the license to operate. After all, innovators of every stripe need the support of a willing public, because investment into research and development and support with trade promotion and the vehicles which are used to subsidize investment into early stage companies, all of those come out of general taxation. And if the general public see people becoming fabulously wealthy in ways which are unclear and which don't clearly bring benefit to the public, there's a risk. So that was the problem that started to really preoccupy me 3 years ago. And I think those problems of trust and bifurcation, splitting, have grown, especially as a result of the pandemic. So in answer to the question, what comes next, I think we either face a huge trust problem, a huge social license to operate problem, or we must find solutions. And certainly I'm very keen to find solutions. And that's the genesis of GenieShares, which is an attempt in a little way to create conditions where even complicated, obscure technologies and businesses can become much more relatable to the general public.
Well, let's just, I vividly remember that first conversation around social license to operate. Talk us through how that evolved into where GenieShares is today, because it's actually an entrepreneurial journey in a very clear way.
Well, GenieShares for me began as a sort of side hustle. It wasn't obviously part of the job at level 39, but I believed and still believe, in fact, believe more now, that there's a really important compact between businesses and the community. And many business people are so preoccupied with what they are doing that they may forget that, after all, we depend upon so many people who are not the usual stakeholders. And that's been brought into vivid, sharp contrast for many people over the last few months as we've realized just how much we depend upon key workers, people who, on the whole, will not be investors into high growth technology businesses, but who are absolutely essential if we want high growth technology businesses to thrive. So it seemed to me that that we needed to find some way of closing this gap. Mm-hmm. And I was surrounded by people who were very good at making the economic argument, the technical argument. We needed to find some format which was not dependent upon those kind of complex cerebral arguments, something which appealed much more to the heart,
right,
than just to the head.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the first sort of sparks for me were reading some research on the way in which premium bonds a couple of generations ago after the Second World War fostered much broader savings through the UK population. This amazing insight that you could persuade many more people to save and therefore get many more people involved in investing into the reconstruction of the UK economy simply by creating these stochastic distributions, these prizes where you had a small but non-zero chance of winning a life-changing amount of money.
You've been around too many fintech geeks. If I can try to translate that for an overseas audience, I'm 55, and when I was a child, my parents bought me premium bonds. They're a kind of permanent bond that came out of the post-Second World War era that was a level of government effectively just borrowing from the public who needed to have that trust in them. But what was exciting was it was a lottery, right, of sorts, right? So you'd either, most of the time you get nothing at all, no dividend, no income return, but you might get £10 or you might get £1,000. So it was quite exciting. So it's that idea. So you're intrigued by the idea of a lottery. And if I just fast forward, because I think you're very immersed in this wonderful GenieShares ecosystem because it has taken off since the lockdown. The original thinking that my recollection of it was that, the idea was to bridge the gap in understanding between the general public, the whole general public, and what it means to be an entrepreneur, to be comfortable with risk, to take equity risk, to be innovative, to find gaps, to go for it, this kind of thing. And you and I are both entrepreneurs at heart. So one of the original thoughts that you shared with me was, what if we have a national lottery, right? And the totally random winner actually gets shares in a company and gets to understand what not just a startup, but a scaling innovative company, what that's like, and a true understanding. And the very first one that you did, that the video was done for, what, a year and a half ago, roughly, was a brilliant example of that. But then it morphed and it really took off because you made a couple of what tech companies would call pivots, right? With which landed the GenieShares. So correct my understanding where I got it wrong and bring us up to date, perhaps.
I think you got it spot on. Although I'd say the bar is a little lower. It's not that we're necessarily trying to help people understand how business and technology companies work, but to accept that it's a good thing that they do. So I don't understand all of the details of how my mobile phone works, but I'm very accepting that it does. Mm. And I'm more than prepared to pay to have one. And I'm kind of conscious that unless we make the case for business innovation, then it will be very hard to justify that use of taxpayers' money when there are so many and growing calls for investment into welfare and health. And every pound spent on R&D is perhaps a pound not spent on the provision of services to people in need right now. So anyone involved in entrepreneurship and innovation, public or private, should really rehearse how to engage people's hearts as well as their heads. And so, yes, right now, you're absolutely right. Rather than a lottery, the state we have is a state of positive uncertainty. And at a time when most of us associate uncertainty with the negative, here's a message which I hope many more people will come to hear and come to enjoy. Right now, hovering like a cloud, if you like, over the heads of everyone in the United Kingdom, are millions of pounds worth of equity pledged by amazing people. Peter Kelly, who you described as the first, the trailblazer of this, he gave away £30,000 worth of equity a year ago. And now dozens of entrepreneurs are following his example. And we've got the backing of Salesforce, which is incredibly helpful because, of course, their 1-1-1 model also expresses how big businesses as well as small ones can, should contribute to their community. And it's the uncertainty which creates this halo effect, which is what the researcher Peter Tufano, who did so much to explain why premium bonds, prize-linked savings, are a social good, it's those halo effects that he describes, which mean that not knowing who wins that equity, who receives it, is actually part of the model. So we have now this positive uncertainty. It could be any one of us who gets a tap on the shoulder from a charismatic entrepreneur who's combining ambition and drive on the one hand with compassion and humility on the other, like your guest next week, Ali Arslan, who is a fantastic pledger with his business Wishlist Alerts.
Yes, and so if people were to, between now and next week, go on whatcomesnext.live, just, that's the domain name, whatcomesnext.live, they'll see the listing for Ali and can look him up before the show. And I love the fact that the show has evolved to the fact that you and I know each other, but quite a number of my guests don't. I've never met them before, and we come in completely unbriefed, and they just chat. So positive, a state of positive uncertainty is fascinating. You've now got to the point where this thing has really taken off this year into dozens, as you said, dozens of businesses pledging part of their business tell us how that works in terms of who can and will receive the pledge. What's the structure and what's the mechanism around that?
Well, thank you. So I guess this is really a key part of it. It's up to the individual entrepreneur who they want to give their equity to. But what we suggest, if you like, the boundaries to this are, we ask that it be 1% of the equity. Mm-hmm. We also ask that people distance themselves slightly from who receives it. So this is not like Secret Millionaire. It's not someone choosing someone else and saying, I choose right to bestow this equity on you.
Yeah.
It actually involves a slightly more humble act from the entrepreneur saying, look, I'm going to trust part of this to chance. I might sort of set the frame. Peter Kelly, for example, whose business Employable helps people into employment, he chose to make his gift inside a job center. It was actually the job center he used to sign on himself when he was inspired to create his business. But he didn't actually say, right, it's you. He randomized that process by taking a time out of a hat and agreeing with his co-founder, whoever sits in that chair to sign on for Universal Credit, that'll be the person at 10:10 a.m. And 10:10 was the time they chose out of a hat. So we are creating those kind of part merit, part chance encounters. So, for example, many of the people who've made pledges have chosen key workers or volunteers or carers. One has chosen an unsung hero of social cohesion. And what we're really trying to do, of course, is not so much identify one person, so much as encourage a groundswell of recognition for the contributions that many different people make to the society which nurtures and creates opportunities for entrepreneurs.
And if people get a chance to go on genieshares.com, correct?
Yes.
That first video was amazing, just seeing that, and for people overseas, the language is really a center where you go to if you're unemployed to look for work in order to receive benefits. And the lady sat in the chair and said, would she be interested in having 1% of this company? Clearly, you know, initial reaction was, what? But it's a lovely, lovely story, really well told by the video production company. And you're talking about boundaries and framing and that level of uncertainty. And it reminds me of helping a friend about 6 years ago put together a TEDx talk. And then they said, maybe you want to speak at this. I went, yeah, well, I can. And she said, but you have to, the TED rules are very strict. You have to go through, here's the theme, and you have to go through a committee, and it's blind, right? And I'm not on it. So there's no favors. So it's a bit like the blind audition. You concept with the audience is the idea. I think you're probably familiar. There's the idea that there was gender bias in auditioning for orchestras. And they thought, well, if we make them blind auditions, it will help. So people would come behind, told to play a piece. They had no idea what they looked like at all. A bit like The Voice, the TV show. Of course, the one nuance to this is quite funny is they found it was still behind curtains creating bias until somebody worked out why it was still male biased. When you come onto the stage and you're dressing up, just like you and I put collared shirts on for this, what footwear do ladies tend to wear? So they'd walk across the stage and their heels would clack. So they couldn't see them and they could hear them, but they knew whether they're male or female. So now many orchestras in the world, you have to walk on wearing no shoes or flat shoes. But so that you've put in this level of positive uncertainty in there. And for me, my sense is that the quite a number of the idea of how much, and just taking the UK, which is where this is based, really focused on the value of key workers, whether they're health service, delivery drivers. And these are people who are not in they're not typically business entrepreneurs, right? That's not their space. And they are key to how the economy works. There was this sudden recognition in many parts of the economy or the populace that key workers are, well, they're really key and they don't tend to get paid very well and they don't get the entrepreneurial awards. So your language of social license to operate by the linkage of, you're not insisting as Gini shares that people give their shares to key workers. As you said, there's other things, but they are taking themselves out of the process of choosing who gets it. But I do have the sense that the pivot towards key workers as one of the groups of people rather than the whole population was very, made it really easy to sign up for a lot of people. And I'm on your WhatsApp group. I haven't got onto any of your calls because typically they're at the same time as the show. But it's a really energized community who are then spreading it around. And perhaps we can shift topics in a moment, but it's great that I've got one of your pledgers on who's has a fantastic story to tell, which he'll tell next week. But let's perhaps give a few more thoughts on Gini shares and wrap that piece up. And then I'm really interested in your further thoughts on trust, because the idea of license to operate and trust are very, very prevalent in governments and politics right now. And I'd love not your political thoughts, because I'm sure you and I remain pretty neutral on that, so that we can have some influence from inside the system. But just your broad thoughts on leadership and trust, I think I'd really value hearing them.
Certainly. So, well, thank you. I guess just to draw the Gini shares conversation to a close. Of course, I've talked about halo effects and I've talked about the trust question associated with business. It comes down to this, though. What we have with Gini shares is an invitation to entrepreneurs, whatever they may be doing, simply to create a really powerful message about why they do it, not what they do, but why they do it, why they are motivated in a way which other people can relate to. So there's much less of the kind of long words I've been trawling through as I describe the rationale behind it. This at heart is just about a driven, ambitious person connecting why they do what they do with someone who perhaps doesn't have the same background or opportunities, or who has chosen a different path in a way which creates incredibly relatable and compelling viewing. And that's what we're doing. We want to make sure that through the dark months which probably lie ahead, mm-hmm. as we adjust to COVID through winter, there will be sparks of magic as people like Ali land in the lives of someone else with a pleasant surprise, a piece of positive, unexpected good news. And it's those moments of magic that we're seeking to make. And of course, we're inviting business people, entrepreneurs, to pledge. we're also actually working with bigger companies. Salesforce is one example, to show how big companies support this. So if you're working for a big organization and would like to be involved, please get in touch, because you can help us to tell the stories of those small businesses that may be in your supply chain, those small businesses that may be employing your former colleagues, those small businesses which are vital to our community and which we've got to get better at helping other people to understand.
Great. And I'll try to segue this. I'm going to stick my own line in the sand. It's mixing his metaphors. There are many large companies that are purpose washing now, that they're coming up with their why because they think they have to. And what's really good, what I've noticed is I truly believe that companies that put purpose and people and planet first and keep their eye on the bottom line will make a profit and can scale it. And Salesforce and Mark Benioff are a fantastic example of that. They really have clarity of purpose, and it's just a really obvious alignment between Genie Shares and Salesforce. So for those larger companies, the caveat for me is, have you actually been, don't watch what people say, watch what they do. Have you actually been doing it for a while before you look to align? Otherwise, there is a real clarity and purity of purpose behind Genie Shares. And from the very first conversation you had with me at the time you were bubbling it around with connections of people you knew, to all of the people who've pledged so far, don't get involved unless you're serious. Don't get involved unless you actually mean this. It's not just a way to look good and, you know, rebadge yourself. So if you're really serious about making a difference to society and building trust and telling a great story about your why beyond making money. And the two of this, you know, I love social enterprise, but I also love social enterprise at scales, right? So, you know, businesses that don't make money can't scale. But if the driver is purpose, it's great. So that's my hobby horse. I'm off. This is something that started out as being, if we think of the geography, for those who aren't familiar, Canary Wharf is this amazing center that was built 20, 30 years ago or more, where many of the banks in Europe have headquarters, huge skyscrapers, and level 39 sits on the 39th and other floors of the centerpiece tower there. And surrounding it are some of the poorest zip codes or postcodes in the whole of Europe. And that was the thing. You could look out the window and go, how does this relate? So for where we sit now in the leadership age that we sit in right now, what are your thoughts on, with all this work you've done around trust, what are your thoughts on trust and leadership right now?
Well, I think one of the topics which really fascinates me is how the middle way often satisfies no one. And of course, it's easy to point to politics and say they have polarized us. It's rather hard to figure what to do as a result of that. So I think there is a real value in a quest for approaches which appeal to more than 50% of us. And I mean a lot more, like 80 or 90%. Mm-hmm. The kind of things around which a leader can build a real momentum. And ironically, perhaps, sometimes I think those things lie on the margins. They lie outside of the mainstream. And the reason for that, I think, is that very often mainstream discourse invites you to choose. You're either right wing or you're left wing. You're either centralizing or you're federalizing. You're invited to choose a place on a spectrum. And I think one of the things that characterizes the most impressive leaders, the kind of people who can build really powerful coalitions, is their ability to span a spectrum, to occupy simultaneously and without conflict or contradiction, a really wide range. So I've spent the last few months with the incredible privilege of being surrounded by people who've answered the call to be Genie Shares pledgers. What they have in common is that they're on the one hand exactly as you'd expect from an entrepreneur, driven, ambitious, hardworking, but they reconcile that with a sense of civic purpose, of public duty in some cases even. And it's that ability to be, if you like, and I've been trying to find a less gendered term. I once would have called it broad-shouldered, but it's, of course, perhaps more big-hearted would be a better way to describe it. I guess leaders, in other words, who can help us to reconcile the apparent contradictions are those around whom we can build the most trust. And it's striking that this requires a real agility and ambition. And if we simply seek to find a middle way, very often we lose out. We don't convince people. People define themselves by opposition, and we can't progress. So, of course, I see that every day with GeniShares pledges. But I see also that those people who, for example, say, well, we need to invest more and we need to save more, and we must be prepared to be decisive as we do so. We must be prepared to decide. Of course, it's always easy to push a decision further away. But if you're prepared and willing to decide, to make difficult choices, it does seem that you've got a better chance of actually occupying a broader spectrum on any given issue. And that's the basis of trust.
I wish I'd left more time for this. We've only got about a few minutes left. What occurs to me in my work with leaders is when you talked about spectrum beginning, it's like an approach that appeals to a lot more than 50%. There are so many 50-50 choices, right? You know, with the Brexit vote, the Scottish referendum, the Trump and last election, it seems like everybody is either on one side or the other. So it really isn't a spectrum people span. It's an either or conversation. And at times of great uncertainty, people lean towards certainty, and it seems easier to lead from fear than to lead from the opposite of fear, a word that Brits don't use very much in the context of business, but to lead from love. And trust is, and by that I'm talking about an energy that sits with and both, rather than spectrum, rather than either or, me against you. And then we get into things like purpose. That's the same thing. You're doing it not for the money, you're doing it for some higher reason. And I just think back to, I imagine you have seen that lovely video that you shared when you had more hair, not much more hair, but when you were going through selection for the Royal Marine Commandos officers. And there'd be times when you would have been out in the field as a young officer when the answers were not, what do we pick either or on the spectrum, but actually to go, why are we doing this? And what do we do next? And actually to go, I don't know what we're doing next, but I know why we're doing it. And I'm asking you to trust me to make the decisions on the journey. That level of clarity of why and humility of the leader to go, I don't know what we're going to do next, but we'll work it out. That kind of strikes me as it's really simple solutions. And leaders I've found who actually embrace that and go, I don't have all the answers, but I'll have the big heart and the broad shoulders, depending on how you think about it, to take the responsibility on behalf of us all. And I'm asking you to trust me. And what we see in this country in particular is we see leadership that go, it's this. And then 5 minutes later, sometimes literally 5 minutes later, actually, no, it's the opposite. And I'm dead sure about that. And then I'm dead sure. They cannot exhibit uncertainty. And I think I love your phrase of a state of positive uncertainty. We'll get through this whole thing. It's going to be a long time. And my prediction is that we're going to have a winter where we're fully locked down in the UK, all right, within weeks. And that's tough, but we need to know that we'll get through it to the other side. And there will be massive opportunity for change. It's a huge catalyst for change. And we just need leaders in business and government who are, geez, I'm on a hobby horse now. It should be your space. Sorry. But we just need leaders in government and in business who actually are willing to go to have clarity of the direction and the purpose and why we're doing it, and then choose that space spanning the spectrum, because people can trust the bigger picture. So it's simply about elevating the context to, let's just stop leading from certainty and polar opposites all the time, and just go from this state of positive uncertainty. Oddly enough, I would trust a leader who was positively uncertain. Sorry, got onto a ramble there.
Not at all. I think any leader faces very difficult choices over the coming months, don't they?
But yes.
The choices must still be made. And I think we must all learn to follow well and forgive and understand that it is very difficult in such uncertainty to make good quality decisions. So followership as important as leadership at a time like this. And the more we can all be forgiving, I think the better we'll all do. But in the meantime, those who can distribute some positive uncertainty, there's never been a better time for it.
Fantastic way to close. It's been an absolute pleasure, Ben. Thank you.
Lovely to see you, Tom. Thank you for having me.